Good evening, everybody, and welcome back to a new topic within our Psychology in the Writings of Rav Dessler series. Someone pointed out to me recently that we are nearing the anniversary of my Prebbe, the one-year anniversary as we enter November. Sure, a wonderful, very calm time for the shul, but a very stressful time, I'm just kidding, but a very, very stressful time for me. And one of the things I remember putting my cover letter for when I was applying for the job was this idea that, you know, psychology and religion were often thought of as being contraindicated, that there was really a stir mene obey, an unresolvable contradiction between the values of religion and the values of psychology. And of all issues that could come up as a conflict between religion and psychology, I think free will would probably be the biggest one. The question of what is determining human behavior? You know, psychology is known for explaining where human behavior comes from, why people do the things that they do. It's based on society, it's based on their upbringing, based on temperament, all kinds of things. I've mentioned before that there's a psychology cartoon that I have hanging in my office at work that says, it's a mother holding a little baby, and she's looking at her baby, and she's cooing, and she says, "Oh, yes, yes, one day you're going to grow up and tell your psychologist what a great mother I was. Yes, you are. Yes, you will. Oh, it's so wonderful." Right? There's this trope, this idea that people go to therapy and they just complain about their mother. Not my mother, obviously, who's here. Hello. But just in general, there's this idea that people attribute psychology that the understanding of behavior is all blamed on one's parents, on one's generation, on one's upbringing, and there's really no blame to be held to the person themselves, and really there's no room for free will. Rav Dessler, perhaps I would argue, his greatest contribution to Jewish thought is his sophisticated and nuanced understanding of Bechira Chafshis, of free will. Rav Dessler passed away in 1953, and he was way ahead of his time in understanding the nuances of what we consider to be within a person's purview of free choice, what it means to have free choice. Because do we really argue that every single person has absolutely a 50-50 free choice on every decision? How do we understand habit? How do we understand addiction? A person whose brain has been altered according to our studies, and it could be argued they no longer have a choice in the matter. So to what extent are they culpable? And to what extent do we say that they no longer have free will? But if they don't have free will, then where's Schar V'Onesh? How do we understand the goals of religious behavior, meaning we need to understand some kind of balance over here. And Rav Dessler has a very often quoted, I would say, probably one of his more famous ideas. If someone's heard of one idea from Rav Dessler, it's probably been his idea, which is called Kuntres HaBechira, the essay, the compendium about free will. He spent a lot of time working on this, and his ideas are scattered throughout the different volumes of Michtav Me'Eliyahu. We're going to focus now, and for the coming shiurim, on what he writes in volume number one, the beginning, where he makes a meaningful addition to Jewish Machshava with understanding what it means to really have free will, and to what extent does a person have free will, and what does it mean if a person doesn't have a free choice in a matter? Does that mean that they're not responsible for the choices that they make? Now, this discussion doesn't have to be talking about addiction. The title of the shiur was Addiction and Free Will. It doesn't have to be relevant only to addiction. People can find meaning in this topic, whether we're talking about being on time for shul or any habit, eating habits, relationship habits. It's not limited to talking about addiction. Rav Dessler is the one who chose to open up the discussion by talking about addiction. And I believe it's because Rav Dessler himself had an addiction to cigarettes. We mentioned this in one of the shiurim before Rosh Hashanah. Rav Dessler himself had smoked cigarettes for many years before learning that they were actually harmful. He didn't know. He passed away in 1953 when he was smoking earlier in life. He didn't know that they were harmful. And he was able to quit. We discussed last time we met some of the things that Rav Dessler used, little tricks to help him overcome. So when he talks about the idea of addiction to cigarettes as a way of introducing the topic, it's not just an offhand example. It becomes more meaningful when you think about a person who literally struggled with the struggle he's about to describe. And that'll be the first part of this year, understanding what it means to struggle with something, to redefine what it means to have free will. And the second part is what's called Nekudas HaBechir, the second half of tonight, where he actually describes how free will works. A very, like I said, sophisticated idea that really has many takeaways. They're going to leave us with perhaps more questions than answers tonight, which is just your incentive to come back next week for part two. So I'm going to share my screen. Again, this everyone has a copy in person. Online, can we see this? Yes. Okay. So again, we'll like to balance the reading together with explaining it outside, so those who are not as comfortable with visual learning and prefer audio learning, everyone will be accommodated, and we'll learn together a very, very meaningful topic. So here it is. Na'avor lefaneinu, he writes, Betur Mashal. He gives an example. Achas mibachiroseinu. One of the examples of things that people have choices about. V'nachar heitev bepratel. Will delve deep into its details. Mishama ashen sigariot harbay. A person who smokes a lot of cigarettes. And again, I'll repeat it. Just picture a person who's overcome this struggle in his own personal life and give it some substance. No pun intended. A person smokes so many cigarettes that every night in the evening he feels chest pain. When he goes to sleep at night from smoking all that nicotine, he feels the pain in his chest. At that moment, when he's suffering and coughing at night and he can't breathe, he commits in that moment, I will never smoke again. Tomorrow, I don't care what comes up, what I think about, how stressful my day is, what the urges are, I will not smoke again. Because if he does, he knows. Because he'll be just as sick and just as miserable tomorrow night if he smokes tomorrow as well. Well, then tomorrow comes. He wakes up the next morning. After just a very, very short amount of time, suddenly the craving and the urge to smoke flares up again. Again, no pun intended. Because of his addiction, because of his pattern of behavior, there is a great craving and desire to continue smoking. And in that moment, he's facing this choice. He knows that he has this desire to smoke, but he also knows he has this fear of being sick and feeling hurt that evening. He has the following conversation with himself. He says, I'll just smoke one. Just one. What's one cigarette going to do? If I have one cigarette, I usually smoke a couple of packs a day. If I have one cigarette tonight, that's not going to hurt me tonight. By relying on that rationalization, he smokes one. Just one. Just literally only one. That's it. For now. All of a sudden, a few minutes later, that same craving flares up again. He repeats to himself the same rationalization. It's just one more. And I've already started today. It isn't like today's going to be a cigarette-free day anyway. So what's one more going to do? Where it's underlined, with that rationalization, he smokes another one, and another one, and he smokes the entire day, and he smokes the entire pack, and he starts the next pack. And that night he's lying in bed, and his chest starts to hurt again, and he has trouble breathing, and he's wheezing, and he's coughing. What's going to happen the next day, and the next day? He already knows, that by giving into just one, he falls into the trap of saying, it's not just one, it's one pack, or one carton. Every day he goes through the same struggle. Every day he goes through the same rationalization. He goes through that same rigmarole where he convinces himself that it's just one more. And yes, I don't want to be sick. Yes, I don't want to be hurt. I don't want to go through that again. But at this point, what's one more going to do? And he knows that just one more means an entire pack because it doesn't stop with one. Again, think about this coming from a person who used to smoke cigarettes, not just a hypothetical example. You can imagine the struggle. If not for that rationalization, not for that tricking himself to say, just one more, tomorrow will be different. If he had a blank slate and two equal opportunities in front of him, on the one side of the scale, he has the desire not to be ill, not to be hurting, not to feeling sick that night. And on the other end of the scale, he has this desire, whatever pleasure comes from smoking, on the other side of the scale. If he had a clear cut, fresh, tabula rasa, blank slate picture to choose between those two things, the desire not to feel sick tonight and the desire to whatever benefit he gets from smoking nicotine, if he had a clear mind to make that decision, turning to page number 2 now, ha'ishun. Certainly, a rational brain can agree that the fear of pain and emphysema and heart disease and all these terrible things should outweigh whatever benefit comes from smoking each cigarette. Why does the weaker force always win out? Objectively, the desire to be healthy and live a long life and not feel sick by itself should outweigh whatever benefit comes from that cigarette. So why in real life does it not play out that way? Why does the weaker force prevail? It's because of that trickery. In that moment, the person doesn't feel, I'm going to die by smoking the cigarette. The person says, this one's not going to kill me. And that rationalization is all it takes to allow something that is objectively inferior. An inferior argument, an inferior desire wins out because of this rationalization, this mental framework This understanding of what it means to just smoke one, or what's it going to cost me, or the not focusing on what it means that one means a whole pack, and a whole pack means a whole week, and a whole week means a whole month, and it means that trickery, that self-deception. It's what allows a person to continue down the path that they don't want to go down. On the second paragraph, now we have to ask the question, if that thought, that perspective, that rationalization is really responsible for what happens to a person, right? So why does it work? Why does that thought prevail and become the dominant way of thinking over what a person knows to be good and what a person knows to be healthy? Can we really argue it's the desire to smoke is so strong that it even overpowers a person's normal faculties of how they think and how they rationalize? We just said, but that desire to smoke is outweighed by the fear of being sick and being ill. In the brackets, he explains, if it wasn't for that fact, why doesn't the person just say, yes, I know smoking will kill me. And I know smoking one means smoking a whole pack, and smoking a whole pack means I'm never going to stop. But you know what? I like him so much, I'd rather die. If that was the reason the person smokes, because the desire is so strong and the benefit is so beneficial, then forget the rationalizations. Forget that. Just simply say to yourself, I know it's going to kill me, but it's really yummy. It really satisfies my urge. Person doesn't say that. Why do they have to rationalize at all? Are we frozen on Zoom? No, not frozen on Zoom. We're just transfixed. We're so inspired. If that thought really was so powerful, that you really want to smoke so badly, you'd rather kill yourself for it, fine. Then why do you bother playing these mental games of just one? I mean, just one. Because that's the issue. That's what happens. Or it's underlined. Mikan underlimedim, from here we learn, from this fact, we are forced to conclude. Shahadam yachal hu la'asiyach daito. Person has the free choice. Person has the ability to not pay attention. Min ha'emes habrur lo. To that which is clear and objectively preferable to that person. The person's own values. Again, the fact that they're rationalizing means that they know that it's not good for them. So they know it's not good for them. Why are they playing this game? A person apparently has the ability and has the inclination a lot to deviate from what they know is actually good for them. And to instead hold on to an illusion, to allow themselves to be motivated by something that they might on their own be able to realize is false and not true. With these two desires in front of him, he's choosing to ignore one of them. He is choosing. He knows which one is true because he has to trick to avoid it. But he has the ability to not focus on the truth and instead to take this new approach of not that I'm going to never stop and I'm going to die, but instead to say, just one. I know in the back of my mind it's not true, but I'm going to cling to that. And he holds on to this illusion. Why does a person do that? It's not because the desire for smoking is so strong. This is what we're going to call free choice. Person has the ability to decide how to look at things. Their cognitions, their perspective is up to them, and they choose what they want to give credence to, what they want to focus on, and what they allow themselves to be tricked by, and that's going to end up being free will, where it's underlined. A person could stop themselves and say, hello, mato elas liba sheker. Why do I keep benefit? What benefit do I get from this falsehood? Halo hametzius lo tatim im demyoni. Reality does not match with my perspective of just one more. I know it's not just one more. Reality does not bear this out. V'sof kol sof im hashmala demyoni yeli keiv chazak b'layla. And I know that if I listen to this first time, I'm going to be sick tonight. I'm going to be ill. V'az v'vaday lo yashin. If that was his perspective, he would never smoke. V'im kein be'achreach ha'adam hu gorem li'atzmo. The person's at fault for themselves, for their own decisions. Umano al lachoshim, how foolish are those who believe sharatzon achalash huagorem liadam lachosh b'taut. People believe that, no, you know why people can't stop smoking? Because the desire to smoke is so strong. No. He calls that foolish. It's not that the desire to smoke is so strong. Because the person in their rational mind can tell you that that desire is outweighed by the desire not to die. It's the belief that they're not going to die from this one. It's the belief that smoking this won't make the habit last forever. He's giving an example of substance abuse, but we can really ask ourselves all the time, we make this decision. I know that when I leave the house at this time, I'm going to be late for shul. Every time. But it's so hard. I know that when I go to this place, I have trouble controlling what I look at. Or when I go over here, I have trouble controlling what I spend. Or I go to the supermarket hungry, I end up buying junk food I don't need. It happens every single time. But this time it's not going to happen. This time I'm not going to struggle with my diet. I'm not going to struggle with whatever it is. Right? Substance use is just his example. We can apply this to any issue that we struggle with. Things that we'd like to do but don't do. Things that we're trying to stop but we can't stop. We're coming a few weeks after the Yom Ha'Nuraim. How many of our resolutions have fallen by the wayside? We try to, and each of us, it's a challenge every single year. We have to think to ourselves, if I try this every single year and it doesn't work, so why am I being complacent? It's because, according to Rav Dessler, what we're doing is we're allowing ourselves to rationalize and to put values above what we believe to be true. I want to be healthy. I know I have to lose weight. I know I have to speak nicer to my family. I know I have to spend more family time. I know I have to get out more. I have to exercise more. I know I need more sunlight. We know. We know all these things. Nothing is new. It isn't that the desire for the shawarma outweighs the desire to be healthy. It's the belief that this shawarma is not going to kill me. It's the understanding that if I make it one more day, I can stop anytime I want. It's that attitude that leaves a person stuck. And by contrast, Dessler argues, the way to overcome addiction, the way to push back against the system, to break the cycle, is not for a person to read studies and listen to people who got ill and listen to their stories and to have people say, wow, it's so terrible to smoke, it's terrible to not eat carefully, it's terrible not to have more family time. That isn't the solution. Because the person already knows that. They already know it's not good for them. The solution is for a person to wake up and to catch sight of what it is that they're choosing, what mindset they're letting themselves be fooled by. At the end of this paragraph, he writes, a person has the ability to ignore these facts or to face these facts. At the end of this paragraph where it's underlined, the ability to choose which perspective to have, the perspective of truth and what's honestly true, or for a person to allow themselves to be fooled by their rationalizations, that is what Bechira means. It means the ability for a person to choose a different perspective that allows them to rationalize. Ubechira is on the next paragraph, Tulia Bo Lagamri. A person has complete free choice to make these rationalizations and to call themselves out on them. Vein Sibasha Tisa Vevosa. No one's forcing a person to be stuck to any one of these mindsets. Elahubiatsmo Hineu Hasiba Rishonala. This person is first and foremost responsible for this mindset. Any person who's ever been successful at overcoming a bad habit or breaking a pattern or starting something new, Shemargish Barul Bilvavo, a person truly believes, Shehu Atzmo Misrachek Min Hademyon, they believe, I was able to turn it around. I was able to stop fooling myself, to stop believing in a lie. Umachriya Lachos Be'emes B'chol Tokef, and I was able to cling to the truth. People, and Rav Dessler probably belongs in this category too, those who have overcome addiction, those whether it's substance abuse or anything else, those who have been able to make meaningful change are able to say, I know it's possible for this and for anything else, because I know what it means to reorient myself and to say, if this is the clear issue, why do I keep fooling myself? I need to stop pretending, like the things that happened before aren't going to keep happening again. It's underlined, person who's never had the great fortune to overcome a bad midah, to overcome a bad temptation. Person doesn't believe in this. They say, it's impossible. I have no choice. I'm stuck. I no longer have free will. It's impossible. For those who have overcome it and they've seen it in one area, they can apply it to something else and say it is possible to make meaningful change. For those who have never been able to truly tackle something, every time that they try, they fail. Every time they believe that there's just no way out, and they continue to believe, the desire is just too strong. Rav Dessler does not mention a certain piece that modern psychology would update in terms of what drives addiction, and that is the idea of withdrawal. Withdrawal, once a person becomes addicted to something, once a person's body becomes accustomed to a certain substance, there is a physical craving. A person can go through sweats and shakes and seizures. A person can really physically go through a terrible time as they try to detox from an addiction. So that's a factor that he is not mentioning over here. This idea that sometimes really draws a person to continue with an addiction is the fact that there's a biological need at some point, which we'll have to get back to. You have to understand, so then what's a person supposed to do? In that case, how are they fooling themselves? In that case, there's a real physical necessity at some point. So then how's a person supposed to make change? Maybe we'll dip into some research in psychology and figure out how that aligns with what Dessler is about to say. At the end of the page, Dessler says, it turns out, in the bottom line is, Hulavchin ba'achdut ha'emes. A person's true bechira means for a person to recognize what's reality, to stop playing the game, to stop getting caught in all these traps, to stop fooling themselves with rationalizations. The diet starts tomorrow. I always have more time to spend with my kids. We tell ourselves this, but then it never happens. And then another year goes by. There's always time for me to learn more about davening. I'll have time later when my kids are older to start taking davening seriously. When? Time is passing by. Nothing changed since last year. So why are you fooling yourself to think it'll change to next year? That's the idea. Addiction is just an example. Each of us can think for ourselves. What's an area which we trick ourselves into preventing ourselves from making change? We're believing we don't have the option of making change. Ba'bechira ha-ra'ah, where it's underlined, and bad choice would be, Hishamavchin gamas ha-shekar kimitzias, when a person allows themselves to treat falsehood as a reality. This is the introduction to our topic. Introduction to understand what it means for a person to struggle. Rav Kessler is redefining it, not as a matter of recognizing the harm of what a person's doing. A person already has these values. A person knows that it's bad. It's really for a person to have the choice, for a person to catch themselves and to look at past examples and to say, if nothing has changed until now, why am I fooling myself to think it'll change going forward? If nothing is a very sophisticated quote. Nothing changes if nothing changes. I know, very, very deep. But nothing changes if nothing changes. It'd be foolish to think that something's going to change if nothing changes. If we don't make a change, why would things change on their own? Are we suddenly going to give more tzedakah out of nowhere? Are we suddenly going to become kinder, more patient with our families? Are we suddenly going to become healthier as we get older? That doesn't sound right. Where is it supposed to come from if not this reframing in the mind to ask ourselves, what am I doing? Why am I allowing myself to go down this path every single time? Allowing myself to get stuck. The idea, whether it's addiction, clinical addiction, just regular habits or just patterns of behavior, the idea is, bechira means to stop fooling ourselves and to recognize what really is the choice over here and what does past experience tell me is on the line. Okay, now we get to the reframe. Now we're going to explain perhaps the more sophisticated part. Not that that wasn't sophisticated, but this is the part I think that's more famous. This is the idea. People talk about Reb Dessler. They talk about Nekudas HaBechira. Nekudas HaBechira translated as the Bechira point, the dot. Chapter 2. He's going to give an amazing analogy, a wonderful analogy to help us understand the battle that rages within each of us, whether it's clinical addiction, substance use, patterns, habits, whatever it is we're talking about. The Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer Tov. There is this battle going on, the right shoulder, left shoulder, the devil, the angel. There's some kind of conflict going on within a person. He gives an analogy of an actual physical battle between two nations, between two armies. Kisheshnei amim nochamim, when two nations fight. And we're imagining now some infantry, physical hand-to-hand combat. Hinei hamilchama hi b'makom harachta. The battle is taking place at the moment of the arrangement where they actually meet. There is a point where this army is coming this way, right? This is one country, this is another country on the other side, and this army is coming to conquer both lands, and this army is coming to conquer both lands. And there's a point where they meet. He says, Kol ma she'acharei tzeva ha'am ha'achad, hu kulo tachas reshusau, ve'ein lo sham shum nigud klal. The area that's behind army number one, those who are watching can see on this side, right? For those that's behind this army, is already fully in their control, and it's uncontested. The army on the other side has no ability to access, and it's not able to even fight and access anything behind the front lines of the soldiers that they're in combat with. Anything that's beyond this army, on the other side, is totally in their control. There's no contention over all the land. This army has already conquered up until this point, and this army is already conquered up until this point. And here they're fighting. There's a particular line. There's a particular point where they're quarreling. But the areas behind each of them are uncontested at the moment. If one of them starts to win and starts to move the army back in one direction, and start to push them back away, now the battle is taking place at the new point where they meet each other. Whereas previously, I'm making up the numbers, whereas previously there were 50 yards behind this army totally in their control, and 50 yards behind this army in their control, and they're fighting in the middle, 100 yards, football field. That's an interesting image. But okay, it's not like a football game, right? They're pushing back and forth, but there's a moment where they're all lining up, pushing into each other, but there's currently yards behind this one that's uncontested and yards behind that one's uncontested. And as this one moves the ball, as this one starts to push back in one direction, there's no longer any contest on the area that was previously under contention because they've conquered it and they've moved the battle this way. And now there was an area that was previously uncontested that now is contested. Hare, shebepal yesh rak chazit achat. In real life, when we look at the battle, there's only one front. There's only one moment, there's only one point of conflict that we're actually seeing. The hand-to-hand infantry is only fighting at one particular point. There are these 30 soldiers over here, 30 soldiers over here. It's these soldiers fighting with each other. But as they move, the point of battle moves. It's the same struggle, it's the same contest, but the moment where they're fighting and how much ground is behind each one, that's what's shifting. Uvakoach, what's happening behind the scenes, called Shetach Shtei Medinos, Humalka Makarev. So now, what does that have to do with when it comes to Bechira? He explains. Keinu gam b'inyan ha-bechira. That's the same thing when a person has a struggle with themselves. A person has this internal battle, what they want to do and what they're tricking themselves to believe is best for them, allowing themselves to fall prey to a bad habit. Kol adam yesh lo bechira. A person has this moment of contest where there's a battle between two forces, the force of good and evil, the angel and the devil, the Yetzer Hara, Yetzer Tov, call whatever you want. There is a point where there's a conflict. Haina ben akudas pegishas ha-emes shelo im ha-emes ha-meduma. Told us ha-sheger. As we already explained, that conflict is the battle between what a person deep down knows to be true and what a person is tricking themselves to believe is a worthy thought, like just one more cigarette won't kill me. A person doesn't struggle with most things. A person who has a problem with substance use may not struggle when it comes to eating or driving recklessly or going skydiving without a parachute. For most things, they understand that it's wrong and they don't have to battle. Should I do this? Should I not do this? Just one more skydiving without a parachute. Just one more hot dog. That person doesn't struggle with that. Most issues for a person are not contested. They're completely behind this army. They're not up for grabs. Person doesn't struggle with, should I murder a person? Should I not murder a person? Well, just one more person to murder. It won't hurt to murder one more person. No, they don't struggle with that. They've been educated from a young age to believe that murder is wrong. And it's not up for grabs. It's not in the moment of contention. He wouldn't dream of doing the opposite. The But there are also things on the other end. There are mitzvahs that a person does without thinking. It's not a struggle. For a person, it could be wearing a yarmulke. For a person, it could be to make a bracha before they eat, because they were trained that way. And they don't have to take an apple and say, should I make a bracha or not make a bracha? On the one hand, it's not a struggle. They grew up that way. And eating an apple is not a big deal. Where it's double underlined. Eina bachira shayaches, real true free will, the real struggle of the armies, is not really happening. Ela bin akuta shebein tzvo shel yitzer tov. The Tzvah Shal Yetzer Hara. It's the point where there's a conflict between the army of the Yetzer Tov and the army of the Yetzer Hara. Harbei Nechshalem B'tamim B'Lashon Hara. Many people struggle with Lashon Hara, and we all know who they are. Many people have a hard time when it comes to Lashon Hara. Mepei Shehurgu Luba, because it's been going on for a long time. Lo Yala Al Daitam Klal Kirahu. And they've grown up with it so long, they no longer see it as a struggle. They no longer see it as something they have to change. They don't think of it as bad. They don't open up their mouth and say, should I use this word? Should I not use this word? Should I talk? Should I not talk? Let me trick myself. They're not even struggling with that. It's not even on their radar. It's completely out of reach. But people like that who maybe violate Lashon Hara without a second thought would never dream of violating Shabbos. Bittul tefillah, or skipping davening, tzitzis and tefillin, things that they grew up with, they would never dream of not putting on tefillin or not going to shul. That's not even on their radar. But Lashon Hara, it's very challenging. It's completely beyond the Bechira point. It's totally out of reach. What he's saying is, you look at a person at any given time, and there are really three different sections of the battle between the Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer HaTov. The three sections are the things that are completely in the domain of the Yetzer Hara. A person has no option of challenging those things. It's not even an option. A person hasn't given tzedakah in 50 years. So when someone knocks on the door, and the person's been throwing people out for 50 years, when someone knocks on the door and says, can I have some money? They're not struggling with the right angel and the left angel and the this and the that. It's so far gone. It's been 50 years of kicking people out that at this point, it's just a habit. And it's not even a habit they're trying to break. They have no contention. It's totally beyond any point of fighting, any point of Bechira, because it's totally on the other side of the army. It's on the other side of the Yetzer Hara. But then a person also has things in section number two, which would be on the other side of the Yetzer HaTov. They've been wearing tzitzis since they were 3 years old. It was never an issue for them. They never struggled with that. Every day they don't say, should I put on tzitzis today? Should I not put on tzitzis today? What am I going to do? What will happen to Olam Haba? How am I tricking myself? No, you put on tzitzis because it's just you wake up in the morning, you put on your undershirt, you put on your tzitzis. You don't think about it. You don't think about it twice. Make a bracha before eating your food. Lighting Shabbos candles. I would argue, for those who grew up religious, most mitzvahs are probably things that aren't a struggle. Most would be in those categories. And most of the things that we struggle with are probably in category one, that are so far gone, so far beyond our ability to access them because they're so esoteric and they're so lofty. The goal is so righteous that it's not even on our radar. We've been doing a certain action for so long that who could even think about struggling with that day to day? The real free will, he's arguing, takes place on the few things on the front in section three. Section three is whatever a person goes back and forth about. Waking up for davening some days yes, some days no. To struggle. This day yes, this day no. 5 more minutes, I'll press snooze again. They struggle with it. That's a bechira point. That's a point where there's contention. But there are so many mitzvos and so many averos that are beyond the purview. Mitzvos a person would never dream of. Tikkun chatzos. It's not a bechira point. A person has a free will, quote unquote, to wake up for tikkun chatzos. I never even thought about that. That's not even on my radar. That's so far beyond. I would never even consider that to be a moment of struggle. Lashon hara for a lot of people, right? Certain things, he's giving us examples where they're not even in a moment of struggle. They're totally beyond either. They're totally in the territory of the Yetzer Hara or totally in the territory of the Yetzer HaTov. And we don't think about them for good and for bad. Mitzvos we don't do. Mitzvos that we do. Averos that we don't do. Averos that we do. Person wouldn't think of murdering. Do you get really full schar every time you don't kill someone? Someone bothers you and you don't murder them. You say, I had really a 50-50 choice. I could have murdered them, but I chose not to. No, murder's not on the table. Murder is on the Yetzer Tov side, way beyond the moment of contention. It's not even a thought. You've already conquered that. That's not Bechira. Real Bechira is only taking place at the moment of struggle. But then, here comes the kicker. Just like the army moves, the Bechira point moves. In the third paragraph. Amnam nekuda zo shel ha-Bechira eina omedas tamid al matzav echad. The Bechira point, the three sections, there's always three sections. But the section three, the point of contention, constantly shifts. As a person does good things, makes good choices, they move the Yetzer HaTov in one direction. Previous battle, a person was not always wearing tzitzis. And then for a while, they struggle wearing tzitzis. And then for 2 weeks, for 3 weeks, it's a major challenge. After a month of wearing tzitzis, you know what? It's second nature. It was previously in area three, an area of contention. Now it's in area two. It's totally so far past, so far behind in the conquering of the Yetzer HaTov that it no longer registers as a struggle. There's no longer a struggle or a fight to keep those things. That's what Chazal call, he says, mitzvah gereres mitzvah. Mitzvah allows a person to put a mitzvah under your belt and make it so habitual and make it so normal and not a struggle to the point where it's second nature. How would life be if every single mitzvah was a 50-50 struggle? Every bracha, every mezuzah, every avera also, to not murder, to not commit adultery, if everything was a 50-50 choice, it'd be exhausting. We have things that are totally in the security of the Yetzer Hara, because we haven't gotten there yet, totally in the security of the Yetzer HaTov, we're way past that. And then there's a few things right in the middle. Mitzvah gereres mitzvah, avera gereres avera. So what does that mean? How does a person start in this process, and how does a person move? Skip down to the bottom of the page. This is how when it comes to a person's education, how a person grew up. Now we're getting to the issue of upbringing. We mentioned before, modern psychology says everything is the parents' fault. How does that fit into this? Person was educated in a good family, with a good schools, and good teachers, and good mentors, where they've been trained. Their challenge is much more lofty, because they got the basics down pat. L'mashal, for example, Mishan is chanech b'chinuch haTorah, bein tzadikim v'anshei ma'aseh. The person grew up in Jewish schools with great leaders and great role models. Next page, last page. Yo'il lo achinuch asher nekudas b'chirasa lo tia ba'asiyas avera b'ma'aseh o b'minias mitzvah ma'aseh. Person's b'chira point is not going to be to throw out their tzitzis or to burn their lulav before it's over. Ela b'dakos avodas halev ha'kavana. For them, the struggle is having kavana during all of davening. Because they've already mastered going to shul. They've already mastered being on time for shul. They've already mastered saying all the words. For them, the challenge is, can you have kavana? That's a very lofty bechira point. But because they've already conquered everything else, for someone else, they're not holding by there yet. Focusing on having kavana for every single word, I don't go to shul yet. That's my bechira point. That's my challenge. But what determines if a person is able to go to shul fluently or not? Two factors. One, how are they educated? Where did they go to school? What was happening in the home? Who are their role models? And number two, your past decisions. A person may be at a point where going to shul is no longer on the radar, because at one point it was, but they've been acting a certain way for so long that now it becomes no longer a struggle. They've let the Yetzer Hara move the army so far that what was previously easy on the Yetzer Hatov side at some point became a struggle 50-50, and at some point moved so far to the Yetzer Hara side that now there's no longer a struggle. They don't go to davening at all. Every person's struggle is different. This person's struggle is to have kavana because they were given an upbringing where it was easy to go to shul. V'yesh asher, yischanech bein rishayim, person grew up a thug in the inner cities where a person had a terrible upbringing. P'chusim v'ganavim, among people who are low lives, people who are thieves. Etzlo lo tia b'chira klal im lignov o lachdol. For a person who grew up like this, there may not even be a choice of to steal or to stop, because that's how they grew up. They're 9 years old. All they know is if you don't steal, you don't eat. Or if you don't steal, you don't push back, or you don't hang out on this corner, someone else takes your street corner, and then you lose out on your business. That's how they were raised as a little child. So where is their bechira point? V'yitachein asher nekudas bechira so, a person like that, and that's their upbringing, that's their starting point. So what is their bechira point? What is their moment of struggle? Tiyarak kisha yizdamin lo l'ratzeach nefesh be'esh yitpas b'gnei vaso. Should a person pull up the gun and shoot the person in the act of the robbery? B'sham hu melchamas yitzrav, that's where his struggle is. Every person has a different bechira point, because every person has a different starting point, based on their upbringing and based on their past decisions. That's where his struggle is at, based on where he started. And that's the kind of thing he can choose to fight with. Where it's double underlined, it's not that certain people are equipped to have free will and certain people are not. People are born moral or not moral. Or they had a good upbringing, so they could be moral. Others can't. Everyone is moral. Everyone has the same choice. El arakis makom nekudasa. The difference is, where is that point for you? Each person's bechira point is different. V'chol adam yishas yitziraso nitam bo hakoach asher yuchal lahakir ha'emes sheyeda. Every person has this inborn ability. As we mentioned before, bechira means to say, I have to stop fooling myself. I have to stop rationalizing. I have the ability to know that something is wrong. There are certain things a person doesn't really have the ability to do. They don't really have the ability to stop and say, am I rationalizing? Am I not recognizing the truth? What do you mean? The idea of davening with kavana is so far gone. Or the idea of not murdering isn't even on the radar. I don't struggle with that. Each person's point is different, and it actually moves throughout a person's life. Amazing idea. Regardless of your upbringing, regardless of a person's IQ, of their temperament, that just determines where the bechira point starts. Each person's different, what they struggle with, what's easy for them, and what's actually a moment of bechira. A person's goal, if that's the case, is not really to desist completely or to jump 8,000 steps. If you look at it like a battle with a front, then the goal is to move the line and to move step by step. And that really is, I think, the modern approach to substance use treatment. I think in a previous generation, they're focused on abstinence. Person is using substances, person is hurting themselves, they have to stop. To find a way for a person just to quit cold turkey. Find things to replace the substances, we'll find ways to help them detox. Person has to stop cold turkey. Some cases that might be indicated. But the more practical and the more widely used approach now is called the harm reduction approach. Harm reduction approach says the person doesn't need to stop cold turkey. Because any attempt to do so will just make them give up, because it seems impossible. As in Rav Dessler language, it's way beyond the bechira point. They're not at that point where they can begin to struggle with that. It's so far beyond what they can be capable of right now. But can a person take the moment that they're at? If the struggle is to use 12 times a day or 13 times a day, that's their bechira point. That's the point currently for contention. Using 90 times a day, off the table, definitely not. Using one time a day, not possible, not feasible. It's not practical to expect a person to go that fast from 12 times a day to zero. And it's not an accomplishment that they don't use 90 times a day. They're not up to that either. Certain things are totally in the control of the Yetzer HaTov. Others are totally in the control of the Yetzer Hara. And there's a few points of struggle. Can we help a person in their moment of struggle take one meaningful step in the right direction? Can they go from using 12 times to 11 times? If they're using multiple substances, can we get them to get down to one? Can we help a person start to develop some healthy habits that go together and help them come before they start to cut back on something? Cutting back on something is much more meaningful and much more feasible than to say a person should quit cold turkey. The idea of the Bechira point, if that's what is developing for us, is so powerful because it tells us The expectation is not to jump 80,000 steps. We have to recognize that there are things that are totally not our fault, or I should say not currently in our mode of control. There are things we're proud of ourselves for doing that maybe we shouldn't be as proud because we've been doing it for a long time and it's no longer a struggle. And there are things that we're not doing we shouldn't feel bad about because they're totally out of reach. The tikkun chatzos, the davening everywhere with the kavana, we don't have to feel bad about that. But we have to ask ourselves, what is my nekudas habechira right now? And it changes all the time. As a person develops good habits, they move it one way. Maybe during Yom Narayim, it moves a certain way. And then after Yom Narayim, it slowly trickles back. That which was not possible, a good behavior to give tzedakah every day wasn't a possibility. During Yom Narayim, it was a struggle, a person had to work on it. Then it became a habit. All of a sudden, it became totally easy, no problem whatsoever. Then we let it slide, now it's 50-50 again. It constantly shifts. Something can go from being in Area 1 to Area 2 to Area 3 to Area 2. Everything goes back and forth, back and forth. That's life. Mitzvah gararis mitzvah, avera gararis avera, the impact of everything that we do isn't just that action in of itself. It's the impact that that mitzvah or avera has on moving a person's bechira point. Every time a person does a mitzvah or an avera or anything, they are not only judged on what's happening in that moment. Is that cigarette going to kill you? But how does that cigarette lead to the next cigarette? How does that shift the bechira point to an area where it's no longer an option to stop? And then the consequences of that one cigarette isn't only the one cigarette, but how it shifts the entire free will paradigm, how it shifts the entire battle, how it shifts the entire tug of war that's going on. And this is the more practical and more widely used approach for treating substances. How can we help a person take one meaningful step today? And aside from moving the army in one direction, it does something else. It helps build confidence in a person. Helps a person feel, you know what? If I can take that step, why can't I take another step? If I can go from 11 to 10, why can't I go from 10 to 9? It's just one more. Tell a person to go to zero, they give up. Tell a person, why can't you just stop with one? In your rationalization, can you actually cut down on one? Can I take one away from you? Can I stop you from bringing 10 to work, only bring 9 to work? Can you make it through one less? Yeah, I think so. Then you adapt, and it goes from being in Area 3 where it's a conflict to being in Area 2 where it's easy peasy. At some point, maybe 12 was in Area 3. Now 12 is long past that. 12 is in Area 2. It's easy. But then that keeps shifting as we go. And that's the idea of overcoming addiction. It's the idea of overcoming any habit. It has to be incremental. It has to be progressional. And it has to be steady, steady. When it comes to substance use, when it comes to bad habits, when it comes to mitzvahs and averos. We'll just end off with this at the bottom of the page. Last paragraph. Hayotzimiz v'reinu, the way it turns out, Rav Dessler says, Shein bechira el ben akudas habechira. True 50-50 choice about a person struggling is only at certain points. But the idea of having, at that point, the ability to make free choices is a God-given gift. The Pasuk says in Parshas Nitzavim, on the third line, Achayim v'amaves nasati lefanecha, we have the choice to choose a life of death or a life of life. It's up to us. Let's keep it down where we'll end off with this, where it's underlined at the bottom. V'zeu gam perish amru chazal. What does Chazal say? Hakol b'dei shemayim chutz mi yirei shemayim. You know what that means, he says? Hakol b'dei shemayim. So many things that happen to a person are beyond their control. Kol asher yekar la'adam, whatever happens to a person, shehu mechinas hadvarim she'aleihem, yesh lefanav habechira. Whatever happens to a person, they don't choose where they're born, they don't choose their temperament, they don't choose their IQ necessarily, that is all min hashamayim. That starting point of the chira point may be beyond a person's control. Chutz mi yirei shemayim. But the person has the choice to make one step today, to move the bechira point in one direction as opposed to letting it go the other direction. A meaningful step today, meaningful step tomorrow, that's how a person starts to shift. So to summarize, our takeaways for tonight. Listen to how nuanced and sophisticated this is. As opposed to saying every single person at every single moment with every single action that they do is struggling 50-50 and has full-on bechira for that, there's only a couple of things a person is truly struggling with. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. That's a person's bechira point. There are certain things that are easy for a person and not so impressive. And there are certain things that are way beyond a person and they're not necessarily held accountable for that. But they are held accountable not just for what they do in their bechira point, but how they move that bechira point, which leads us to our teaser for next week, because it raises a lot of questions. As I said before, we're raising more questions than we're actually answering. If this is the case, that most things aren't in the actual bechira point at any given time, is there not schar va'onesh for doing things that are easy for us? Does a person not get schar for wearing tzitzis because it's been doing it for 30, 50, 70 years? Is that what we're saying? A person who's so far gone into an addiction or to a habit that it's no longer a 50-50 struggle, are they not punished because they no longer have it in the bechira point? Are schar va'onesh canceled because of this perspective? Are we arguing there's no longer free choice, therefore there's no longer culpability for things outside of Area 3 right in the middle? We're not going to say that. But that this raises the question. We have to understand, how does this Bechira point work with the idea of Schar Va'onesh? How does Chinuch, how does the idea of parents and affecting children, how does that play a role? So please, tune in next week. Please join us again as we continue this foundation about the idea of a Bechira point, of the two armies battling, to understand Schar Va'onesh, and how each of us can make a meaningful change every single day.